It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. 2016 is a big year for Pittsburgh as we celebrate the 200th anniversary of its incorporation. We're spending some time sifting through some of the city's most significant moments. In a recent article for Pittsburgh Magazine, Robert Morris University editor and adjunct professor Mark Hauser highlighted a dozen of these moments in an article called Looking Back, 12 Days That Changed Pittsburgh. He joins us now, Mark Hauser. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks very much for having me on the program, Paul. It's my pleasure.
Before we get into the specific dates you've featured, I'm curious how you chose them.
That was a lot of fun, actually. I think some of them were obvious. So as far as...
Mazz's home run. That's the most obvious one, right? 1960.
Actually... Yes and no. Yes, because clearly it is the biggest moment in the city of Pittsburgh that had to do with sports. I have to say, though, that I'm a Steelers fan more than a Pirates fan, and I have a lot of sympathy for people that say the Immaculate Reception is the most important sports moment in Pittsburgh's history. But Mazz's homer wins a World Series, and you know, Franco's Immaculate Reception wins a game in the playoffs, but we lost the next week to Miami, so... In fairness, Mazz's homer in that Game 7 is more important.
Fair enough. So, again, back to the question of how you chose the moments that you included in this piece, 12 Days That Changed Pittsburgh.
Well, I think I was trying to make sure that I picked days throughout the course of our 200-year history as a city. I tried to make sure that we weren't taking everything from the 1900s or the 1800s, for that matter, and even got one in from the 21st century. But the first one was obvious, and since Pittsburgh is a city of bridges, the first bridge that we had in Pittsburgh was actually built in 1818, and they opened it on November 21st. It was called the Monongahela Bridge, and to me, that's essential Pittsburgh. It's the first of this bridge in the city that would become the city of bridges. And I think one of the fun things I learned while researching this story is that there were 10 toasts with cannon fire and champagne that the workers and the owners of the bridge celebrated the opening. And the first toast was to the state of Pennsylvania, first in the Union for the number and beauty of its bridges. Before we were the city of bridges, Pennsylvania was the state of bridges. And the person who designed this bridge, the Monongahela Bridge, was a designer, Louis Wernwag, who had made a bridge in Philadelphia that was pretty famous in the early days of the country. That first bridge in Pittsburgh went from the south side to the point, just in the exact same location that the Smithfield Street Bridge is today. It was a covered wooden bridge, and it lasted until the Great Fire of 1845, and then it was burned to only the stone piers remained. And the replacement that it was built for it was the first suspension bridge built by Roebling, who lived in Saxonburg, so he was an engineer and an inventor. And he used that bridge and developed those concepts to his eventual masterpiece, which was the Brooklyn Bridge. But that's a Pittsburgher, too.
Seeing as it's an election year, let's talk about what happened politically in 1856 in Pittsburgh.
Well, 1856, February 22nd, is the first convention, the founding national convention of the Republican Party. And it's very interesting looking back at how, in some ways, history seems to repeat itself. But at the time, in the 1850s, there were two political parties. One was the Democrats, and this was a pro-slavery party at the time. And the other party was the Whigs. And we sort of laugh because they have a funny name now and there aren't any Whigs today. But the Whigs, you know, Abraham Lincoln was a Whig. This was a major prominent political party that had presidents and so forth. But the Whigs were split into factions. And there was a faction that was opposed to slavery. They were abolitionists. And there was a faction that wanted to try and bring the party together and avoid this issue of whether slavery should be abolished or whether it should be allowed to expand into new territories or whether it should be kept where it is, which was the major political question of the day. A powerful faction in the Whig Party at the time was the Know-Nothings. And the Know-Nothings were a group that their strategy was, let's stop talking about slavery because this is hurting our party because we can't come to a conclusion about what position to take. So instead, let's focus on the real issue, which is immigrants. We need to oppose immigrants. We need to oppose these Catholics Irish, Germans that are coming into our country and ruining it. And so the Republicans were the group that thought, no, the real issue is slavery, because if slavery keeps expanding, and at the time, the Southern Democrats wanted to make all the new territories decide by popular vote whether they wanted to be slave states or free states. So that led to things like Bloody Kansas, with John Brown fighting in each of these territories to see who was going to win that vote. So the Republicans in Pittsburgh founded this party, and they nominated only one candidate at that convention. It was the one state office that was open. It was Canal Commissioner. And they nominated an abolitionist from Philadelphia named Passmore Williamson. And what Passmore Williamson was famous for, he'd just been jailed because he helped a slave, a family of slaves, a woman and her two young sons, escape from a politician. He was from North Carolina, and he was on his way to Nicaragua to become the ambassador, and he brought his favorite house servant with him and her sons. And when they got to Pennsylvania, Williamson, with the help of some other abolitionists, sort of accosted this politician at the docks when he was getting on the steamboat for New York and then to Nicaragua. There were five black dock workers that sort of held him back while they announced that her right was to walk away if she didn't want to be a slave anymore. And she did, and she went and lived in Boston. And one of her sons grew up to fight in the Civil War as a member of the Union Army, as a black soldier.
A fortuitous event in more ways than one.
Yeah, absolutely. It would make a great film for sure. And the Republicans that year did not win. They nominated a guy from California named Fremont. The one who won that year was Pennsylvania's only president, James Buchanan. He was a Democrat. But 4 years later, the Republicans nominate Abraham Lincoln, and we know what happens from there.
We do indeed. Pittsburgh has long been known for its innovative medical techniques, especially the creation of the polio vaccine by Jonas Salk. What did this mean for the city of Pittsburgh and for medicine in the 20th century?
Well, there's one stark statistic that explains what the polio vaccine that Jonas Salk developed means, meant for America, not just Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is where he began administering it in Arsenal, actually at Arsenal Elementary School in 1954. But in 1952, 58,000 Americans were struck by polio, which often caused infantile paralysis. Can you imagine the terror of parents anticipating, you know, whether that, when they hear their kid cough, is that the disease that's going to cause them to become crippled? And what really is an inspiration, the real heroes, of course, Jonas Salk is a hero for developing the vaccine. But I live right next to the D.T. Watson Institute up in Leet Township. And an amazing story about the polio vaccine's development is the kids who were at the D.T. Watson Home for Crippled Children, who were the guinea pigs, the first ones that the polio vaccine is tested on. So Jonas Salk goes out to the home and tells these kids, I've developed what I think is a vaccine to cure polio. I need to test it on people. We've tested it on animals, and we want you to be the first. And they ask him, will I be able to walk again? And he has to tell them, no. So unfortunately, you will always be paralyzed. You'll always be crippled. But if you help us test this vaccine, you could save other children from having to suffer the same fate that you have. And I mean, they can look around them. They've already had polio and suffered from it, but it could get worse, you know? What kind of a, how would you feel as a parent? Can my child be injected with polio virus again? Or some of them are grown, you know, some of these are young adults. You know, you can see someone next to you in an iron lung, maybe just your legs don't function. Are you ready to take polio virus again just for the sake of helping other people? So if there's not already a monument for these kids that were at the D.T. Watson Home for Crippled Children, there should be. I mean, it was through their unselfish action that we were able to develop polio vaccine. And I mean, their story reminds me of the another medical story that we tell, which is about these heroic Irish nuns who've come to the country in a climate where Catholics and Irish immigrants are not well thought of, and set up the first hospital here in Pittsburgh, which becomes Mercy Hospital, but it's in their convent. They're living in a hotel. They've just opened it, you know, a year ago, and now they announce on New Year's Day, 1846, anyone who's ill, we will care for you. You can stay in our hospital. and, you know, the doctors of the city will come visit you, and while you're here, we'll care for you, and we'll keep watch over you and pray for you. So a year after they open this hospital in their convent, while they're building a permanent one, there's a typhus outbreak. Now, these nuns know, because everyone knows, that if you sit around typhus patients, your chances of getting typhus are very high. And yet they bring in 19 typhus patients and care for them, you know, wipe their sweat off of their brow and watch over them and keep them company. And they save 15 out of the 19 patients. But four of the nuns, including a convert from Pittsburgh, Eliza Tierney, but four of those nuns die. I mean, they basically sacrifice their lives in order to take in the sick and care for them. And that's heroic, too. And right after this happens, then, of course, in a way, they kind of shame the city into other groups in the city that we should have hospitals. This is a great idea. So Passavant Hospital opens, and the Protestants opened that the next year, and then West Penn Hospital opens. But it was these immigrant nuns, and not in their own country, taking in people that probably were not very happy that they were there in the first place, took them in and nursed them back to health.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Mark Hauser. He's an adjunct professor and university editor at Robert Morris University. He's written a piece called 12 Days That Changed Pittsburgh for Pittsburgh Magazine. You've heard about some of those days and the events associated with them. The story of Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright August Wilson is also one of Pittsburgh's most inspirational. And I'm curious, Mark, why Wilson's legacy has endured, in your opinion. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, the short answer is he won two Pulitzer Prizes, and all of his plays are about Pittsburgh. They're set in Pittsburgh. I mean, one of the 10 of his cycle is set in Chicago, but the other 9 are all set in Pittsburgh. And his story is so inspirational. And this is a guy whose father walked out on the family. I mean, he took his mother's name because he didn't want to be, you know, associated with his father, who had abandoned him, a white man. His mother is black. He tells the stories about growing up in the Hill District, but he tells stories from his own experience. And just the idea of a sophomore in high school writing it, his sister said that he was a walking newspaper. So he actually wrote a term paper for her when she was in college. But he wrote a paper for his sophomore history class about Napoleon. And the teacher, as Wilson tells it, it's a Gladstone High School. The teacher calls him up after class and shows him his paper, and he has an A+ and an E on it. And he says, "I'm going to give you one of these two grades. Prove that you wrote this paper and not your sister in college." Hmm. And August Wilson says, "I'm not proving anything." The teacher circles fail. August Wilson tears it up, throws it in the trash, walks out, and never comes back. But the thing I heard him, he gave an interview after he'd won his Pulitzer talking about that story. And the tragic thing is that the next day he goes back to the high school and shoots hoops out in front of next to the principal's office, like under the principal's window. And he said he was hoping the principal would come out and say, "Why aren't you in school?" So he could tell him. But no one asked. Principal didn't come out, no one did. And so he was a high school dropout. He actually got his diploma from Carnegie Library.
Well, that's where he went to study, which I think is probably as amazing an aspect of that story as any, and maybe was a benefit to him, because he said during the hours that he was supposed to be in school, he just went to the library every day and read, and look what happened.
Absolutely. And here I have to make an admission. I mean, I've written for most of my professional career, and I'm interested in plays and drama in Pittsburgh. But it's not easy to see August Wilson's work. I mean, it's occasionally performed, but to read a play is not the easiest way to approach a work, right? And so I think, like me, a lot of Pittsburghers, though they have heard of August Wilson and know who he is, haven't really read his stuff. And I wrote the story, I went back and I read Fences for the first time. And it's such an amazing story. I mean, how could Pittsburghers not love this story? It's a baseball dad fighting with his football, you know, son about sports and about all the questions about honor and duty and responsibility and loyalty that, you know, that apply to everyone's life. And what a blockbuster. I mean, it set a record on Broadway. He got the Pulitzer a month after it opened on Broadway. It was that big of a hit. It set, you know, records for box office, records for performances. He won Best Play, Best Director, Tony Awards, and when it was revived with Denzel Washington again. But the reason many people have yet to see his work is because it hasn't been made into a film. Hollywood wanted to make Fences into a film, but August Wilson demanded that the director should be black because it's about black people, and it should be directed by someone who understands their lives.
And now that's going to happen. Denzel Washington is going to direct a film, and it's going to be made right here in Pittsburgh.
So that's fantastic, both for Pittsburgh to have a show like that made here, which it naturally should be, but also we'll finally have the opportunity to see Fences, if outside of a theater, but on a television screen.
Okay, we're talking about baseball, and so we should probably circle back to what we were talking about earlier, which is a moment that ranks right up there for anybody who grew up in Pittsburgh, whether they're a baseball fan or not, if they're old enough to remember 1960, or even if they aren't. The only time there has been a series ending, World Series winning home run in the bottom of the ninth inning of the seventh game was when Bill Mazeroski did it at Forbes Field for the Pirates against the Yankees in 1960. You included that in your moments, and you mentioned, well, yeah, it won the World Series, so that's part of it. But there's more to it than that, really, about how it affected Pittsburghers. What would you say about it, Mark?
I just love the idea of Pittsburghers, a throng of fans pouring out of Forbes Field and headed out to party, going, you know, going downtown or out in Oakland in the streets, just that it happened right here. And there's, of course, that famous picture of people watching from the top of the Cathedral of Learning. But it was not just in Pittsburgh that the celebration happened, and this was maybe my favorite story. Bing Crosby was a part owner of the team, and he was like many sports fans, Pittsburgh fans particularly, he was extremely suspicious. So he didn't want to be anywhere near Game 7 when it happened, but he wanted to hear it. So he went to Paris, because he's Bing Crosby, and he listens to the game on the radio with his friends in an apartment in Paris. And when Maz hits that home run, Bing is standing at the mantle of the fireplace with a bottle of scotch in his hand, and he gets so excited, he bangs it on the mantle, and the scotch pours out all over the fire, bursts into flame, and he almost burns down the apartment in Paris.
That's great. And I'm sure the French understood exactly what it was all about. What a story. Mark Hauser has more history than we can possibly fit into this segment. And after hearing some of those details, I'm sure you can understand why. But you can see his piece, 12 Days That Changed Pittsburgh, in Pittsburgh Magazine. It's in the most recent edition, and folks can check that out. In the meantime, Mark, great work. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. We really appreciate it.
I've really enjoyed it, and I'd like to tell your listeners, if they'd like to hear some more history, I'd invite them to go to my Downtown Walking Tour podcast at rmu.edu/tourpittsburgh.
Great stuff. Thanks again, Mark.
Thank you very much, Paul.